12 Who Shaped San Diego, a series of radio programs on local history, radio biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego.
The geographic region which encompasses San Diego and Tijuana, and which had a unity in the Spanish and Mexican period, and certainly has a geographic unity, had this artificial line put into it.
The period just before the establishment of that boundary is the subject of this program, San Diego's Mexican Period. José Antonio Estudillo was one of the most important citizens of Mexican San Diego. This was the time of the Spanish Dons, an era of old-world elegance for some, but also a difficult time in the life of a rapidly changing Mexican pueblo. Don José Antonio Estudillo's life is also interesting because he lived here during a transitional period in which San Diego paid allegiance to three different nations, first Spain, then Mexico, and finally the United States. His life is the subject of this fourth program in the series, 12 Who Shaped San Diego. I'm Peter Hamlin, and joining me is San Diego historian and chief historical consultant for these programs, Dr. Claire Crane. Claire, our preceding program in this series discussed Captain Henry Fitch, and in that program we discussed the beginning of the Mexican era here in San Diego. Could you give us a recap of the Mexican era? When did it begin, and what were the major events of that period in San Diego's history?
Well, it's sometimes it's even called the Mexican interlude because it was such a short period of time, really only 25 years, from 1821, when the revolution took place in Mexico that made it independent of Spain, until the American conquest in 1846. So we're talking about a very short period of time. The important factors for San Diego during this time, I think, are that to begin with, after the revolution, it meant that there was much less control or direction or protection or aid coming from Mexico City to California. And the soldiers, for example, didn't receive anything. And the residents of the area felt insufficiently protected from the possibility of attack by foreign nations or from Indian uprisings. So the residents consequently became much more independent. And, of course, later on we even hear of them thinking about the possibility of establishing California as an independent nation in the same way that Texas did at about the same time. They wanted to organize their own economy and their own government to meet their own needs.
What were the circumstances of Don José Antonio Estudillo's arrival in Old Town?
Well, he came here with his family in 1827. Perhaps he had visited earlier, but basically they came to settle in 1827 when his father was assigned as commandant of the Presidio, and his father remained commandant of the Presidio from 1827 till his death in 1830. And at this time, of course, José Antonio Estudillo was a young man, and he got married and decided that he wanted to settle down. And so he asked for permission to have a house lot and build a home and start a garden in the area down below the Presidio, in this area, which subsequently became what we now know as Old Town. And, of course, this was what a number of the other retired soldiers or young men who were not in the military wanted to do. And this led directly to their desire within another few years to establish a civil government in the area instead of just being under military rule.
We pick up the story now of Don José Antonio Estudillo as told by Troy Jordan, who is a historian at the Old Town San Diego State Historical Park.
By 1827, he's just really beginning. He's a young man. He's been married just 3 years, and so the family's starting off. And eventually, through his own abilities and talents, he becomes more and more prominent. Well, he affiliates himself with more of the prominent people, Juan Bandini, the Picos, the Criollos. And so they're pulling him along with him, with them as they rise too. He's awarded or granted a few ranchos here and there, Hanal, Otay, and eventually he has property in San Juan Capistrano, downtown San Diego, La Playa, which is near Point Loma, and various other places. So continually he rises in importance and influence and wealth. He gets into the cattle industry during the hide and tallow trades and trade days, and primarily his major wealth comes from the hide and tallow trade. He eventually was the mayor of San Diego, and this is in 1837-38, and his office was over in what is today the Rodriguez Building, Racine and Laramie's Pipe and Tobacco Shop. Later on, he was the first county tax assessor, he was a city tax collector, he was a custom official, port official, revenue agent, judge of the plains, and various other offices that he held. The alcalde, the mayor position, was strictly honorary. It was not a paid job, but it was one of honor. So he was a very prominent and influential man.
As this program progresses, we'll be taking a closer look at this man and the events briefly alluded to that surround his life in old San Diego. The house that Don José Antonio Estudillo began building in the late 1820s still stands and is a part of the Old Town San Diego State Historic Park. Of course, the house that you can see today, fronting the town plaza in Old Town, has had quite a bit added on since those times. But in the days when San Diego was a part of Mexico, the Estudillo House, along with a few other prominent homes, was a social center for the community.
In the days when José Antonio was in his prime and flourishing and wealthy, this house was a center for, you know, some balles, the balls, dances, weddings, special occasions when dignitaries would come in. Often they were entertained here in the house. Governor Echeandia at one time resided in the house here, and then various other dignitaries from time to time stayed in the house. So there was a lot of entertainment here. In the courtyard at one time, there was a bandstand erected, and they had dances, a big, not only a bandstand, it was a dance floor, and the band played around it.
Let me tell you this, when they had a fiesta, it used to last for 2 or 3 months.
Old Town's fiestas were indeed major events, and they are described by Roberto Estudillo. He's a resident of Tijuana and the great-grandson of Don José Antonio Estudillo. His mother was born in the Estudillo house in Old Town, and she would often tell him about those magnificent fiestas that periodically brightened the streets of Old San Diego.
And I asked mother why, how they could have a fiesta for such a long period, such a long time. And she gave me an explanation. And for instance, they'd have a fiesta once a year or once every 2 or 3 years when somebody would get married, some of the parents of or relatives. So they would invite people from Santa Barbara, Santa Maria, up to San Francisco. And it used to take them 2 or 3 months to get into the old home, into San Diego. You can imagine there was no highways in those days. They used to ride in horse and wagon. So it'd take them probably another 2 or 3 months to get into a fiesta. So, and they'd be stopping by with all their relatives because it was just one big family. The whole state was intermarriages between one family and another were so very few people in those days that they intermarriage. Like the Picos and the Osunas and the Machados, of all the old families, Dominguez, they all intermarried. So it was just one big family. So when they had a fiesta, they invited the whole the whole territory to come and have this fiestas. And I used to ask Mother, well, what did you do to entertain your guests for 2 or 3 months? Well, we used to have barbecues every day, rodeos, horse racing, dancing every night, the dance all night. So you can imagine how they entertained themselves in those days. They had beautiful horses that were famous for their horsemanship riding. They had the best horses in probably in America.
Roberto Estudillo, great-grandson of Don José Antonio Estudillo. I like to associate Old Town during this period with the gayer moments like the fiestas, but of course, these great events were hardly the regular fare in a sparsely populated and lonesome town. This has been the subject of study of Charles Hughes, archivist for the San Diego Historical Society.
My research shows then that that type of life did exist for the very few at the top who controlled a lot of the economic resources of the territory then. But for the large group as itself, the majority of the people, then they had a very hard time of it. They didn't have the resources then to profit from the commercial exchange that was going on between the American traders then and the other Californios and the ones that were profiting from it. They had ranchos. They tried to grow a crop each year and raise their cattle and then to go on and exist then. The idea that it was a very opulent era, that it was sort of like the antebellum South, that really didn't exist then for the large part of the population then.
We may not only romanticize our history, we may simply forget the seamier details of the historical picture of Old Town in the 1800s.
At that time, 1835, it's pretty a desolate area. You're going to see at this time of year, you might see some mud puddles here and there in the street if it was, you know, rainy. If it was in a period of drought, there'd be nothing but dust blowing around, very few plants. At that time, too, you're going to see pigs and chickens running around. People are griping about the pigs bursting into the house. The Picos at that time gripe about the fact that a pig gets into their kitchen and eats a year's supply of stores. And you have raids by all the things, animals. In that day, they didn't have a sanitation department, per se, at least not a human one. It was animals. And that's why they kept a large amount of dogs around. In that day, too, when they wanted meat for the kitchen, you didn't slaughter the cattle out in the fields and bring them in. You brought the cattle right to the back door, right to the kitchen, slaughtered it right outside the kitchen door and prepared it there, and you just left the mess right there. And then you relied on chickens and cattle, goats, whatever, dogs, to clean it up for you. At that period, too, there are not too many houses in Old Town. The population is not too great. It's really a tenuous situation here. Water is the most pressing problem at any period of time, whether it be a lack of it or too much of it. But there was no happy intermediate position, I don't think. They either had a lot of it or they had very little of it.
Troy Jordan, historian at Old Town State Park. And what of the dons themselves? We think of an old world Spanish elegance, especially in connection with the wealthier families, like those of Don José Antonio Estudillo and Juan Bandini. The Bandini house, by the way, can also be seen in Old Town right next to the Estudillo house. Some of our best descriptive information is found in the writings of Richard Henry Dana, author of the famous book 2 Years Before the Mast. Dana has left us vivid descriptions of Old San Diego and its inhabitants, and a brief sampling is shared with us by Dr. Iris Engstrand, professor of history at the University of San Diego.
Bandini is kind of a character that Dana gets to know. And he has kind of an unusual description of him, which I'll read to you. Dana describes Juan Bandini as he has returned from Mexico as accomplished, poor, and proud, and without any office or occupation, to lead the life of most young men of the better families, dissolute and extravagant when the means are at hand, ambitious at heart and impotent in act, often pinched for bread, keeping up an appearance of style when their poverty is known to each half-naked Indian boy in the street, and they stand in dread of every small trader and shopkeeper in the place. He had a slight and elegant figure, moved gracefully, danced and waltzed beautifully, spoke the best of Castilian with a pleasant and refined voice and accent, and had throughout the bearing of a man of high birth and figure. Yet here he was with his passage given him, as I afterwards learned, for he had not the means of paying for it, and living upon the charity of our agent. I should add at this point that the fortunes of Juan Bandini sort of went up and down with the times. He overinvested at times in land and had some financial difficulties, but money was very scarce in Mexican California altogether, and actual pesos were very difficult to come by. Most business was carried on in the form of barter. The hides from the ranches, tallow, were traded for things from the Boston trading ships. And Dana was somewhat prejudiced, we'll have to say, from his own background. He was sort of a Puritan, Anglo, typical from Boston, and sort of thought that the Californios were just a little lazy, too much show, too little work. And this was his sort of his overall impression. And he felt that they should, you know, really be toeing the line a little better. And although he does admit finally that perhaps it's the weather, the climate in California is so easy and nice that even the most dedicated Yankee after a while in California would succumb to this easy life.
Well, Claire, despite that cultural bias, I would imagine it's rather fortunate to have such rich descriptive material of Old Town San Diego through the writings of Richard Henry Dana.
Oh, yes. In his description of San Diego as contained in his work 2 years before the mast, I think we get a quite an accurate picture of what it was like in the 1830s. He came with his ship in 1835. This was a ship that was engaged in the hide trade, and he spent a good deal of time in San Diego. He writes, "The first place we went to was the old ruinous Presidio, which stands on a rising ground near the village. It is built in the form of an open square and was in a most ruinous state, with the exception of one side in which the commandant lived with his family. There were only two guns, one of which was spiked and the other had no carriage. 12 half-clothed and half-starved-looking fellows composed the garrison, and they, it was said, had not a musket apiece. The small settlement lay directly below the fort, composed of about 40 dark brown-looking huts or houses, and three or four larger ones whitewashed, which belonged to the upper class. This town is not more than half as large as Monterey or Santa Barbara and has little or no business." Well, you can see from his description of the Presidio and of the soldiers that although Dana did not have this in mind, it certainly was going to be picked up by other people in the United States who could say, aha, good place, and certainly is going to be easy to take it over.
Richard Henry Dana, as you've mentioned, was just one of many Yankees making their way to the Southwest, as was Captain Henry Fitch, whom we examined in last week's program. The early trickle was to become a steady stream, and finally, with gold discovered in California, a flood of migration.
Yes, it's certainly interesting that if gold had been discovered earlier or had been recognized, actually, I guess there were some Spaniards and Mexicans who had discovered a little bit of gold, but they didn't regard it as terribly important. The knowledge was not widely spread. But had it been discovered earlier, who knows, maybe we would all still be speaking Spanish here. Maybe the Mexicans would not have allowed California to be taken over. They might have been able to resist. Well, the Mexican War, I think, really stemmed from a desire for California. Not for its gold, because that was not known about at the time, but for its good harbors and for its good land into which the population could spread. The American desire for California went back to the 1830s. During the administration of Andrew Jackson, there were attempts made to buy California from Mexico, and even during President Polk's administration in the 1840s, just before the Mexican War, what we call him, the Mexican War, there was another attempt made to buy California, but Mexico did not want to sell it. So the a boundary dispute as to what the boundaries of Texas were actually gave Polk an opportunity to say, we have been invaded, the United States, a portion of the United States has been invaded. American blood, as he said in a famous phrase, has been shed on American soil. And so he asked for a declaration of war, and that was quickly given. The Mexican War, as we call it in our textbooks, took place almost entirely in Mexico. It was an invasion by the United States of Mexico, and most of the battles were fought there. The conquest of California was relatively easy. As indicated earlier, there just was practically no military force with which to resist it. And as a matter of fact, many of the Californios, the Mexican residents of the area, were by no means unhappy that California was going to be acquired by the United States. There was virtually no resistance when the Americans came in initially, but then the arrogant behavior of some of the American soldiers, especially of Lieutenant Gillespie, who was in charge of Los Angeles, aroused resistance among the Californios, and this resulted in a series of essentially skirmishes in California. The bloodiest battle actually in California was fought at San Pascual, up near Escondido. And the forces, the American forces there under General Kearny, were defeated by the Californios, riding their fine horses and wielding their long lances against the American troops who were unfamiliar with the area, were tired from their long, long march, and their powder was wet, their guns didn't fire properly. The Americans suffered about 20 killed and about the same number wounded, and soon after that, the capitulation of Cahuenga was signed, and the war came to an end.
Just what did the Californios, the citizens of Mexican California, feel about the great changes that were being signaled by the increasing interest in this area on the part of the United States, after which California became U.S. territory? And again, we turn to Charles Hughes of the San Diego Historical Society.
It's generally my impression that the Californios accepted the U.S. Rule in California. When the Cayenne sailed into San Diego Harbor in July of 1846, the California population in San Diego did not resist. They accepted it. You have to go back then to understand this whole attitude then or response on their part to the Mexican period, the later Mexican period, following the secularization of the missions in the 1830s. All type of social order completely collapsed. There was an outbreak of Indian violence. The Californios and the Indians were constantly warring with one another. Californios were forced to abandon their ranchos and to seek protection in the Old Town area. At one point, there was a conspiracy to completely annihilate the California population, and there this conspiracy was uncovered, and the leaders were put to death. The Indians believed that the land was theirs. The Californians believed that they also had a right to it. And there was this conflict constantly going on. In 1831, I believe it is, the San Diego's population was over 700 people. And at that point, they had petitioned the Mexican government for local rule, and they were granted a city charter in 1835. By 1837, then, the population had declined, and they no longer had the enough people here to continue with their the city form of government that they had, and they became a district of L.A. then. And by 1841, the population is about 119 or 150 people. So there was this tremendous decline in the population. People left the area then. It's my impression that they're both trying to eke out an existence in a very hard land and a very harsh environment, and there wasn't that much to go around, and so the Californios had to exist, and they took what they could control, and Indians resisted it, and wanted what was rightfully theirs, they felt.
So they may have appreciated the stability, in a sense, that came with the U.S. government. Is that part of the reason why that was accepted?
Well, the officers came in and they promised that you would have, we would give you protection. We would establish social order, and you would also become an expanding part of this, or the part of this expanding commercial empire of the United States and things. And so it looked very, very good for them. You know, nobody anticipated the discovery of gold in 1848 and subsequent migrations of 100,000 Anglos or better then, and this complete transition that occurs then in the first few years following the conquest. Californios thought that they would, you know, remain the predominant group, and they would have this protection of the United States government, and they would become a part of this expanding, growing commercial empire and things. It looked like a very good deal for them.
We'll examine in a moment whether United States rule was indeed a good deal for the Californios. Dr. Richard Griswold del Castillo, with the Mexican-American Studies faculty at San Diego State University, also notes the important cultural differences that existed between the Anglo-Americans and the Mexican Californios.
I think one of the problems was that the Yankees, the Anglos, had a kind of superiority complex, which historians call manifest destiny, of that period, which was that the English-speaking people had in their genes, practically, the God-given right to settle and conquer and all of North America. But almost every Yankee or Anglo-American who moved into the Southwest had this kind of preconceived notion of superiority over the other peoples who were living there. So it's very difficult for the Mexican people to fit in to or to accommodate themselves to this kind of attitude. And for the Anglo or the English-speaking people, it had to be only one way with them as the God-given appointed rulers of this particular area. It was really the tragedy, I think, in California in particular, that the Mexican people, culturally, as everybody knows, are very hospitable and gracious, and they were perfectly willing to accept non-Mexicans into their society even after the Mexican War. There are a number of secondary associations, political clubs and so forth, that had Anglo-Americans as members and even leaders along with the Mexicans. But unfortunately, it didn't work the other way. That is, the Anglo-American Anglo-Americans weren't willing to tolerate the Mexicans as equals in politically or socially after the Mexican War.
The war ended in 1846, soon after it began. The United States and Mexico agreed upon the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which established the new border and several guarantees to the Californios.
The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which guaranteed property rights of the Mexicans residing or staying in the United States, was violated in spirit and law. The Mexican landholders here were deprived of their land through a variety of ways. The state legislature passed a law in 1851 called the Ginn-Ant Land Act, which required that all landholders prove before a court of claims up in San Francisco that they had legitimate title to the land. This threw into question all the land grants in California, which opened the possibility for squatters to claim portions of different ranchos. And of course, the litigation expenses were very large. The rancheros had to hire lawyers and translate documents, and the average time it took to get a case through the court to approve the land grant was 17 years. So it was a very drawn-out process. During that time, they had to sell their lands and cattle to pay lawyers. Ironically, in the end, the courts, or the commission up in San Francisco, legitimized most of the grants, but by then, most of the grants had been sold or had been taken away by force by the squatters. So the prejudicial laws passed by the state legislature here in California were largely responsible for the loss of lands, but there were other things such as land taxes and cases where people had to borrow money. There wasn't a usury law then, and they borrowed money at exorbitant rates of interest, something like 10% a month compounded monthly, and to the point where people were, and a lot of these Californios didn't understand high finance, didn't understand interest rates or loans, and were used to a very informal type of economic relationship. And so they were willing to sign deeds as security over to lawyers and to banks and other people without realizing what it was that they were doing. So in the end, through their ignorance or lack of sophistication, they were tricked a lot of times into losing their, or giving away their lands. So taxes were another way. Property taxes were something, the type of property tax that the Anglo-Americans brought with them was something different than what the Californios had been used to. In Mexico, and the Mexican law was that land should be taxed for what it produced. So if you had a huge rancho of, you know, 100,000 acres, and you only had 10 cows on it, those 10 cows were taxed. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Anglo theory or approach was that land should be taxed for what it could produce, the maximum production value. And so in Southern California, the Californios, who owned these huge ranches, all of a sudden had to pay huge taxes, despite the fact that, well, at least after 1863, their cattle were pretty much decimated, so they had to sell the land to pay the property taxes.
Dr. Richard Griswold del Castillo with the Department of Mexican-American Studies at San Diego State University.
I think another thing that's important in understanding the whole problem with the land grants is the very different attitudes that Americans brought with them. They were accustomed to a system in which people had, relatively speaking, small holdings. They would have 80 acres or 160 acres. You know, the Homestead Act, for example, was based on a 160-acre piece of land. So to most of the Americans, the concept of these enormous land grants, because the land grants in California were 5, 10, 20,000 acres. It was by no means unusual to have 20,000 acres, and of course some of the grants were as much as 50,000, the Warner Ranch grant, for example, or as over 100,000 acres. So certainly to Americans, this was much too much land, and their whole attitude was, why shouldn't this be carved up into smaller pieces? This is a much more democratic approach.